This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Steven Siegel, here on New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies and New Books Food, today with our guest, Allison Smith, and she's the author of Cabbage and Caviar, A History of Food in Russia, just published by University of Chicago Press and Reaction Books 2021. Thank you, Allison, so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks for inviting me. It's really fun to talk about this project.
So I read this book and I got really hungry. I want to start with that principle. A little bit about Allison. I've been a fan of her work for years on the Russia History blog, and I wanted to mention what she is and what she does. And so she, Allison Smith, is professor and chair of history at the University of Toronto. She's published widely on the history of socialist states in Tsarist Russia and on the history of food in Russia, culminating in this book, Cabbage and Cuisine. I'll mention a few of her works. In 2014, she published For the Common Good and Their Own Well-Being, Socialist States in Imperial Russia, Oxford University Press 2014, out in paperback 2018. Recipes for Russia, 2008, Food and Nationhood Under the Tsars, published by Northern University Press 2008, out in paperback as well, 2011, and a new book edited together with Matt Romaniello and Tricia Starks with Bloomsbury, 2021. This book, I can't wait to read. It's called The Life Cycle of Russian Things, From Fish Guts to Fabergé, out this year as well. So I want to talk to you, Allison, about this, because you've been a food historian and a social historian of Imperial Russia for so many years now. What motivated you to write this book?
Well, this is something that actually came to me in some ways. I had, you know, my first book, my dissertation project and first book were on food in a relatively narrow time period, sort of about the 1760s or 70s through emancipation in 1861. And I sort of came across, you know, that was something that I came to actually in part due to somebody who you have recently interviewed, Steve Bittner, who I was in graduate school with, who mentioned that food was a hot topic. And I thought, well, that would be sort of fun. And I went to my advisor, Richard Helley, and said, I was thinking of maybe doing something about Russian food. And he said, I've always wanted to know what the Russian peasant ate and let me go do whatever I wanted to do when it came to the history of food. And I really, I did enjoy working on that project, but I had the same thing that I think many people do when they finish off a first sort of dissertation book, which is of never wanting to go back to that topic again. I'm feeling completely like burnt out on it. You know, it's such a long process. You know, I had, my PhD was 2000. The first book came out in 2008. So it was a slow process to get, you know, in retrospect, it was a needed process, but at the time it felt like a very slow kind of unending process to get that to come out. So I had this moment right after that where I thought, I will never write anything about food again. I am done with this. And then of course that ends up not happening. So I have a chapter in the Oxford Handbook of Food History on national cuisines that I was sort of asked to contribute out of that, which was sort of one thing of saying like, well, maybe I will still write some things about that. And then I have a chapter in an earlier book that Trish Starks and Matt Romaniello edited on the senses in Russian history about taste. That was really the first sort of pulling me back into thinking about food history. So I had sort of made peace with the idea that I might continue to write things about food. But at the same time, you know, I did this whole second project on Soslovia and have been moving into a third project that maybe we can talk about later.
Sure.
And then actually, I was contacted by Reaction Books to maybe contribute the book on food to their series of histories of national cuisines.
Yeah.
So they have a whole series, you know, there's a history of food in Germany, which is, I believe, called Beyond Bratwurst. You know, history of food in a whole bunch of places. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And so they, you know, I was sort of approached to do this. And I have to admit that I very much kind of hemmed and hawed a bit about whether it was something I wanted to take on, in part because, you know, I do have another project that I'm interested in working on, and in part because it was a very different sort of writing challenge to the sorts of, you know, the academic monographs that I had written before. I was approached to do this with the concept that this would be a general history of food in Russia and something that's aimed at a general audience. I think it was sort of an educated general audience or something like that.
Right.
So that struck me as a really interesting set of challenges. One was moving out of my comfort zone of Tsarist Russia or Imperial Russia and needing to actually write about the Soviet era, which I'd never really done before, needing to write about earlier periods, which I'd taught all of these things but never written about them. And then also the challenge of thinking about how to write something that's less focused on argument, the way that, you know, sort of academic articles and monographs tend to be, and more focused on narrative. And I ended up deciding, I sort of was approached about doing this right at the time when I was actually contributing pretty regularly to the Russian history blog, which was in a lot of ways a short form version of that kind of writing, trying to present historical material in a different voice to the one that I normally wrote in. And so I ended up deciding that it was an interesting challenge to take on. And then of course it took, it took some time. It was a bigger challenge in some ways than I expected, but also I think a really rewarding one in the end. So I'm glad, very much glad in the end that I agreed to do it. And then sort of had the space to take it on and put some time into it.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions starting from that. And one of the biggest questions that I have for you, and I think our listeners will be intrigued by this, is all of the sources that you have managed to gather to give in this book that multisensory feel. It as I read it, it was an experience. It was almost like a dining experience. And so one of the first questions that I had was, how do you convey that sense of sitting at a Russian table, being part of the table, whatever it is, however defined nationally, traditionally, transnationally? Did you think about that when you were developing the chapters and the draft for the book?
I did. You know, when I wrote my sort of dissertation and first book, I wouldn't say I fell into, but I, in retrospect, I suffered a bit from one of the challenges that I think academic food history can have, which is that sometimes the food itself isn't that present. You know, you don't get a sense of the fact that something would be really delicious, or that it would, you know, sort of the whole sensory world of it. And that's in some ways why I was really grateful to be pushed into thinking about taste for the edited volume on the senses in Russian history. So thinking that was a very narrow vision of taste, but still it was a sort of helpful moment in thinking about other ways of talking about the subject. So when I sat down to think about how to put this all together, know, there are some ways in which my sort of other side as a sort of social historian is very much there. You know, and I've, one of the things that I think has been true for me throughout, even in that earlier project, is really thinking about food as something that's not just on the table, but something that is produced by people, you know, that is that is harvested, that is hunted, that is gathered. And I, in some ways, I think this has a lot to do with some of my childhood reading. I loved the Little House on the Prairie books as a kid.
Is that right?
Which now, in like in retrospect, there are some things that are challenging about those books that anyway, I look back on it and think like, But the thing that always got me about them was the process stuff. The like these rich descriptions of storing food for the winter and like what a larder looked like. And the, I mean, the process, like I have vivid memories of the sort of bits about slaughtering a pig. Not, it's not a bloody thing, but like what you do with all the parts. And so I think I've always had this interest in, that side of the history of food. And so this was really a chance to get to sort of lean into that a bit more than I had in some of the earlier things that I wrote. So it was, you know, I tried to, I came up with, you know, for all that they approached me about this, I still had to come up with a proposal and think about how it was that I was going to approach it. I think I initially suggested something with like four or five sort of thematic chapters and then a history. And in the end, it's ended up with sort of two general chapters at the beginning, and then just the history, you know, the rest are all just sort of move us through history. And part of the reason for that was I realized that, especially if this is for just non-Russianist audiences, I needed to say, like, say, what is a pirog? What is shi? What is borscht? You know, what is, what are pelmeni? So the first chapter tries to introduce food. And I think my favorite part of the book is actually the introduction to that chapter, because it is a celebration of the Stolovaya at the Leninka, the library, the main library in Moscow that I think many listeners may have spent a lot of time at discussing.
Genius soup is what you, is how you describe it. they do have people who are genius soup makers there.
Yeah,
I swear.
I mean, you know, these are wonderful institutions now, and so just sort of thinking through this as a way to introduce the different ways of, you know, the various different elements, thinking through the experience of eating in a stolovaya, which I think some people might think like, oh, why would you do that? But I actually really love the stolovaya. So for me, it is part of a sort of a really a positive feeling about, you know, my own experiences in Russia and about Russian food and eating in Russia. So those were some of the things that led me in that direction.
I'm curious, Allison, you know, since we're talking about soup and how you begin with soup in your introduction, how you deal with some of the stereotypes, perhaps, or at least kind of common impressions that people might have about Russian food. They think Russians are equals vodka, or they're always eating borscht. You historicize the potato, and you do a number of really interesting things in the book to show how nutrition and taste change over time. So perhaps could you introduce to those who haven't read your book yet, content-wise, what's in the chapters and how you're dealing with some of the sort of staples, shitakasha, pishanasha, that sort of thing. And maybe with that, again, like stereotypes, what people think of when they think about Russian national dishes.
Absolutely. One of my joking versions of the title was fewer potatoes than you might expect, because I know that potatoes are, you know, the thing that everybody thinks about when they think of Russian food. And of course, it's such a relatively recent part of Russian eating. So I open with two chapters that just try to give a lot of background to the things that sort of lay behind the history of food in Russia. So the chapter one looks at sort of Russian dishes, the things that appear on a Russian table, which I organize by sort of different parts of the meal. And I think, again, anybody who's ever gone to the stolovaya or canteen or cafeteria, for anybody who is not a Russianist or a Russian speaker, sort of they are always organized sort of the same, where you have a salad to begin. You have a first dish, which is a soup, and a second dish, which is some sort of a meat dish generally, or maybe a vegetarian dish or something like that. And then some sweets, perhaps, a baked good, and certain drinks. So I thought that was a way of introducing the broad array of the foods that would sort of appear and reappear throughout the rest of the book. And then in chapter two, I also think it's really important to think about sort of why those foods and why various, why those foods, both as things that are prepared and based on ingredients. And so it looks a bit at the history of agriculture, the effect of environment on Russian foodways, what the expansion out of the sort of old heartland of Rus, which is very northern and very forested, into the southern steppe region, and then certainly its expansion into what are now a whole series of separate countries, what that did in terms of affecting Russian foodways, thinking through some technologies of preservation, just sort of trying to give a sense of the sort of work that went into preparing foods. And I think, again, that's partially because of my love of things like, you know, this sort of process literature in some ways. But I also think it's really important to know sort of what was going on behind the scenes in a lot of ways. And then the rest of the book just sort of moves chronologically from, you know, sort of beginning with archaeological digs around Novgorod, and elsewhere to think, you know, to try to think about what we know about Russian eating in the earliest days of Kievan Rus or of sort of Russian settlement around Novgorod and further north, which is, in, you know, there's really fascinating things that you can find out about this, but it's all, it does feel like sort of being a historical detective and picking a couple of little clues and trying to build a larger narrative or a larger vision of what was going on from that time. But that said, you know, it did make me think like, oh gosh, I wish I had become an archaeologist and was working on these kinds of materials that people have found. It's truly
That's
amazing.
Interesting. Yeah. I really thought of you in many ways as sort of like in the spirit of Carlo Ginzburg and Natalie Zimon Davis, you're hunting for clues. And in many ways, though, you know, if I may say so, though this is a book that's covering thousands of years from Rus and the pre-Petrine period all the way up to, you know, the post-Soviet espresso drinkers and McDonald's, which we can talk about, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love the fact that you're actually still dealing with sources from the inside. And many of these are sort of like cookbook writers, people who wrote those and became, you know, those books that became bestsellers, as well as that external travel literature and ethnographic sort of observation. And that's what I wanted to ask you next. So I wanted to ask you a question about your sources. I know that I can't imagine anybody has read more than you in the history of cookbooks in the 18th and 19th century for Russia. Could you tell us about some of those writers and you know, who was their audience and how you found some of their works?
Sure. So this was the 18th and early 19th century sections are the things that I wrote about a lot in my first book. So that was the thing that I knew best. And it was interesting that chapter, maybe it actually ends up being two chapters because it's what I knew the best, were the things that I had tons of notes on. You know, I was able to pull out various things that I'd taken notes of, you know, almost 25 years ago at this point. Certainly more than 20 years ago, and that had never made its way into a piece of writing. Like somewhere in there, there's a few lists that I found, and I like copying out lists, and, you know, but it's hard to fit a list into something that is making an argument. Mm-hmm. But I was like, this is where I can
put my list. Recipes are not arguments.
Exactly. Or like lists of seeds or things like that. But it's, you know, so I was able to use a lot of material there. I think that there are, I think my favorite cookbook author who I came across from that first project, who appears a fair bit in this, it was Katerina Avdyeva, who's a really interesting figure. She became, I think, the first sort of really kind of blockbuster cookbook author in Russia with her cookbook, The Handbook of the Experienced Russian Housewife. And it is, you know, she squarely aims it at, you know, what she describes as like the middling status, the middle parts of Russian society, not the wealthiest people, obviously not the poorest people, but sort of people who are trying to create a comfortable home in sort of 1840s, 1850s. Her first cookbook was printed and reprinted and expanded in many editions over a couple of decades. So she sort of predated Elena Malachovets, who's, of course, the more famous person.
Right, Gifty Young Housewives, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So Avdyeyeva predated her by about a decade and a half, something like, maybe it's even two decades. About two decades. And, you know, I think that she was the first cookbook author who I started reading things and just like sort of getting her, like she really differentiated between foods that were Russian foods and foods that were like part of the Russian table, which I found like there's so, her works are really interesting. They've got introductions there. She's quite a fascinating figure. Her brothers were the Polovoy brothers, who were sort of kind of maybe medium level literary figures, also in that early 19th century world. And so she was sort of hooked into some of these areas, but has a very distinct presence in a lot of ways. So she's a fascinating figure. And I have at various points thought like, oh, maybe it would be good to go back and just do a deep dive into her. But we'll see. At some point, I may find time to go back to her. I did at one point think that I had pretty successfully read the vast majority of cookbooks. I mean, not literally from cover to cover, but looked at least the vast majority of cookbooks that were published between the 1760s and the very early 1860s in Russia. I'm sure I missed a few, but I definitely looked at an awful lot of them. For this book, when I had to expand the chronological view, I didn't aim for that same kind of comprehensiveness, I have to admit. So it was, you know, sort of doing work, taking advantage of a couple of, you know, being in Moscow or St. Petersburg, also taking advantage of the fact that both the Leninka and the Publichka, which are the big libraries in Moscow and St. Petersburg, have digitized pretty amazing numbers of books that are now available through their library catalogs. So I was able to pull up yet more things when I was working here in Toronto. So really trying to, you know, not trying to be comprehensive, but at least trying to get a sense of how things had developed. You know, of course, the big famous Soviet cookbook is the Book of Tasty and Healthy Food, or it might be Healthy and Tasty. I always forget which comes first. And so I looked at various several different editions of that cookbook, also a few other Soviet cookbooks that I sort of came across that seemed interesting in various ways, and just tried to use those in a whole bunch of ways to just to add texture, I think, to the actual descriptions of food.
Right. Well, could you introduce some of the foods? That's my next question. So we've been talking in an academic way around this, and I think really, you know, back to the pre-Petrine period and some of the sources from the early Slavic world. What are some of the foods that you find as staples?
Well, of course, there's bread. You know, bread is sort of at the base of everything. And of course, the Russian bread is famously a sour bread, generally a rye bread that was sort of baked at times in really huge loaves, although not always in really huge loaves, but in, you know, pretty significant quantities. And that is really such a basic part of Russian cuisine that it's still a part of it, even if the sort of sour rye bread is sometimes not as popular, I think, in the current day as some others. But it is, I think, really an essential part. You see that in, in very early records, you get hints at it. It sort of shows up all throughout. There's always concern over baking bread and the quality of bread and the amount of bread and the size of loaves and all sorts of things. So that is really one of the essential things. I think the other thing that, everybody always thinks of borscht as this really Russian thing. Yeah, but that is, of course,
Ukrainian.
That's actually really, really kind of a fighting statement in some ways. Because it more came from Ukraine. I mean, it becomes very common in Russia, obviously. I may have eaten a lot of borscht in Russia. I've got, but it's, you know, certainly it's a sort of later sort of 19th and 20th century sort of major part of like what you would consider sort of Russian food. And it's shi, or cabbage soup, which is the one that's the true, like the sort of the longer lasting Russian soup. I remember when I was indexing my first book, I had this huge problem of how to subdivide the entry for she, because I mentioned she so many times.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, yeah. And you have the recipes for it in the back. I should mention to our listeners that your recipes are fabulous at the end. I think you have five different categories for she, right?
Well, it is one of the things that shows up in a whole bunch of different ways. And I'll note that they're all historic recipes that I have literally just translated. So I'm not sure how actually cookable they are, but, at least they're there.
We won't worry about that. So say a word about dumplings, too, if you could. So I know that Avdeeva, someone you mentioned, and she's Siberian, right, or a native of Siberian. So we're talking about pelmeni, but other different kinds of dumplings. Give us an overview, if you can.
Oh, gosh. The famous ones are probably pelmeni and varieniki, although varieniki are, again, more associated with Ukraine and having sort of come in. In some ways, I think that the dough wrapped around a filling in various ways is very common. So whether it's the sort of boiled or pan-fried, or there's a version that's sort of pan-fried and steamed, pelmeni are the small meat-filled ones that are associated with Siberia and often with being frozen. There's a lot of debate over the etymology of the word pelmeni, but it might have something to do with a word for ear, because they're sort of twisted up like a tortellini is the thing that people who aren't familiar with them might be more familiar with. Varieniki are bigger, and they can be filled with all sorts of different things. Potatoes, now cabbage, cheese, meat, fruit, many different things. There's also the pirog, which isn't the dumpling, because it's generally a baked thing. But that is, it's mentally grouped in with these. Again, it's a dough encasing something. That can be, again, cabbage, it can be fish, it can be meat, they can be large, they can be piroshki, which are smaller. There is the kulabiaka, which is sort of the most grand, that's filled with like a large piece of fish and various other fillings. But those sorts of filled pies are, and it's sort of pie and more not of a sweet pie, but of a savory pie, is probably even of older existence. Those are again things that you see references to in very early sources because they were such a common thing. And again, these are all sort of really smart foods, because they both sort of take a small amount of protein and expand it into a full meal by adding maybe some other filling, adding some bread with it, something like that. So they can be very sort of basic comforting foods that are really, sort of extending limited supplies of certain things. And then of course they can also be they can be elaborately decorated. You can, add all sorts of ingredients to the insides of them. This book that, this edited volume that we've got coming out, the fish guts part actually refers to mostly to isinglass. But there was another good called Viziga, which is the dried spinal cord of fish like sturgeon, of cartilaginous fish, which was used as a filling in pierogi and things like that. So there's all sorts of sort of unusual variants on these that maybe not unusual, but like lots of different variants on these. Oh my gosh, and I forgot mushrooms. Mushrooms are, of course, a classic filling for all of these things. Mushrooms. Right. What would Russia be without mushrooms?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50. NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Here's where I want to go with you or to ask about Kvass. You have so many interesting sections, I think, and your book is layered and textured around this question of nationalism as well as regionalism and tradition. And I guess, you know, people would be surprised in many ways to read the history of Kvass and to think of Kvass as perhaps even more common than vodka. I mean, how did you get at that other issue? I mean, this seems like a big issue for production and for consumption of beverages. What's the history of Kvass, and then sort of the larger kind of more intellectual question, how do you begin to investigate that as a historian?
So Kvass is a very lightly fermented beverage that is brewed often out of sort of stale or leftover bread. So it's got sometimes a slightly sweet flavor to it. It's definitely, it is something that many people say has a decidedly acquired taste. There are some wonderful accounts by travelers who go to Russia in the 18th or 19th century who are just completely taken aback by the taste of Kvass. There's one description of something like the queerest, most acidic drink ever. Like it is disconcerting to those who have not acquired a taste for it. But it was really very much the everyday drink. You know, vodka is something that comes in exactly when it's still a little fuzzy. It's definitely there by the 16th century, maybe the 15th century, but definitely by the sort of later 16th century. But that was something that was, you know, like people did not brew vodka at home. That was a thing that was brewed centrally and sold. There's actually an argument in an article by David Christian that there's a sort of surprising period of prohibition in Russia during the First World War. But that period of prohibition may actually have sort of created some real problems because there really wasn't sort of samagon or home-brewed or home-distilled sort of hard spirits as a general thing in Russia sort of until there was this prohibition when that sort of came, and it made it harder from that point on for the sort of state to keep control over hard spirit consumption. But again, you know, so that was something sort of very separate. But Kvass and then to a certain extent beer and mead were the things that would actually be brewed, say, in a village, in a town, sort of at home, in a household. And I think, you know, there's a couple of things about this. And one is, of course, that, you know, people didn't drink water the way that we drink water now. And so Kvass was, you know, that was the drink you drank if you were thirsty, you know, that was the thing you'd bring out to the fields.
But it like as you mentioned, there's that special Georgian mineral water that sits on the table.
Right? Yeah. And you know, and so Kvass was the, you know, was that drink. You know, so that was the thing. Like if you're working, you know, there's among the other sort of visions that people have of Russia is that like, oh, it's such a cold place. And of course, it can be very cold, but it's also got a continental climate. So its summers can be significantly hotter than some summers in Western Europe. You know, certainly on the steppe, like summers can be very hot there. And, you know, people brought Kvass to the fields to drink and to sort of, they wouldn't have called it rehydrating, but that's what they were doing. And so it just became this very common, it simply was this incredibly common drink. And again, it's something that you see references to very early on. It's also something that's used as an ingredient. It can be the base for certain kinds of shea. It can be, used to help start a sourdough bread. You know, there's all sorts of things because it's, you know, again, there's some fermentation going on there. So it's just a really sort of very ever-present thing. And to find it sort of, it just appears all over the place. It's one of those things that I think with a lot of things when it comes to certain kinds of food history, it's, you don't actually have to go searching for things too much. You just have to be looking for them. And so, you know, there are certainly, when you start looking at cookbooks, you realize that there's all sorts of recipes for this. When you say, look at travel accounts to get descriptions of food, And in some ways, it feels weird to be writing about Russian food using a lot of foreigners' description of that food. But that is, you know, frankly, that is where I found a lot of the most vivid descriptions of sort of what a meal might be. And it's, you know, so and trying to use those descriptions in a way that is sort of takes them not at face value, but actually thinks about like what's going on with people talking about them seem to be the way to go. But you see kvass pops up in all of these places. You just you just start noticing it all over the place when you start paying attention to it.
Yeah. And I guess to be fair, I mean, you have a lot of descriptions, like Illyrius is a good example as a travel writer who's describing. And yet, you know, I think you do a really interesting work combining Russian literature as well. There's that famous scene in Tolstoy where, you know, Levin finally succumbs to excess after he's, you know, I forget if it's oysters or something like that, but he's actually shown, you know, these great kind of symbols of excess and modernity. So, you know, you're combining a lot of the kind of Russian cultural history and literature with observations of people from the outside. I wonder if you could talk about the chapter where you speak about Russia becoming modern. So here, you know, less than continuity, I'd like to ask you about change. So, you know, first, it begins in many ways with Peter the Great and the well-known story of Westernization and modernization, all the rules he has for people to do certain things. But what, I mean, what prescriptively would you say changes in the late era of the czars? And, you know, ultimately we come to the 20th century and the history of famine, scarcity, and so forth. But what are some of the big changes that you see in the late imperial period in terms of food and drink and diet?
Sure. I think there's a couple of things. And so one is certainly the rise of the town. Because, of course, you know, there's so many debates over sort of Russia's, like whether you can call a town a city. And like there are so many debates in Russian history. And I don't try to go into that too much. But I think that one of the things that you really do see is a vision of towns becoming more central to sort of the vision of what's going on in Russia. Sort of the time of nobles and serfs on their estates is sort of pre-emancipation. And then after emancipation, there's just a lot more sort of investigation and thinking about life in towns. And that's maybe a bit of an overstatement, but I think that's been one of the ways that I've tended to think about it sort of more generally. And then it is a thing that really starts popping up here. Now, certainly things like, you know, some of the things that I tried to think about were things like the rise of restaurants and the rise of other sorts of eating establishments in towns to serve different kinds of populations. That's something I'd thought about, like they existed, you know, well before the end of the 19th century. But I think there are some real changes that start coming in later in that century, both in terms of the numbers and in terms of the idea that there are different kinds of things serving, you know, a larger population as you get more people, largely peasants, migrating to towns to work, and just sort of really changing the vision of what's going on in towns. And so there's different ways of thinking about that. I was able to, it was funny when I was in Russia a couple of years ago when I was sort of simultaneously trying to do some of the research and some of the writing on this, which was an interesting experience in various ways. And I actually really enjoyed, I've never done writing while I was in Russia, but I did on this particular trip. And it turned out that a former undergraduate and MA student of mine from here in Toronto, who's now finishing up his PhD at Illinois, Felix Cowan, was there and was working on his project on the penny press in late imperial Russia. And I asked him, say, by the way, are there ever advertisements for like restaurants or stolovaya or things like that?
And he said, truck deer.
Exactly. And he said, what? Yeah, there actually are. And so he started just sending me some of the like images of some of the ads for them. And that actually really helped me sort of conceptualize what this world of sort of everyday eating was really starting to look like in the later 19th century, early 20th century. So I'm really grateful to him for sharing a lot of those things with me because they really helped inform that part of the project. I think there's also things, you know, like there's the big expansion into Siberia that sort of happens, not like obviously Siberia has been part of the Russian Empire for centuries at this point, but the sort of there's a sort of population movement of Russians into Siberia that happens. And that actually does create some real changes in food ways and sort of where food is being produced and where it's going. So there's some real shifts that are going on in terms of what's being produced where. And things that are being produced in a more, I mean, it's not like this sort of industrial food production that we have now, but something that's sort of moving in that sort of way, I guess I would say. Whether that's sort of large scale dairy industry in Siberia, or as I think both Chuck Steinmetal and Susan Smith-Peter have written about a bit, sort of the growth of a sugar beet industry in certain parts of West European Russia, then sort of Ukraine and some of the near empire, I guess. So there's just shifts like that that are going on as well.
And could you say a few words maybe about there's such an abundance of literature now on the history of famine. And I think you've integrated that in the later chapters and in the Soviet chapter. How did you do that? I mean, there's the familiar story that a lot of people will have in political memory of Leningrad and the Leningrad siege. There's also humanitarian intervention. There's the Holodomor in Ukraine, the 3.9 million deaths. I mean, how are you integrating that into a book about food in cabbage and caviar?
Well, I thought that because I tried to think about this as something that wasn't just about sort of what appears on people's plates, but to be part of the story is what doesn't appear on people's plates. And some of that is famine, you know, and famine is a sort of background issue in the history of food in Russia from very early in its history. And so it's something that I tried to start weaving in the early chapters of the book. You know, I think that there are, you know, because there are references to famines in the earliest chronicles, you know, so this is a thing that is known. And to me, this is an essential part of the history of food. I think that there's a sort of vision of the history of food as being sort of like light and fun, but it also, to me, if you're trying to really encompass the way that food is part of human existence, the lack of food is a driving force and a really major bringer of change at some point. I think I started to see that in part out of my first book because it wasn't a major famine, but there were a series of crop failures in the 1830s that were really frightening. There was a real fear that they were going to turn into something very bad. And that did push for that created some real change. And so I think because I sort of realized that in that project, I've always been aware of that as a major issue. So it's something I absolutely wanted to be part of the story. So to me, this sort of, you know, there's these early moments, but then the big famine at the end of the 19th century is to me a really centrally important moment in that story of late Imperial Russia. You know, it's something that I think was a real shaking kind of experience that was, not only was it deadly, but it also, you know, I think created some real, you know, I think it's too strong to say like, oh, it directly led to the fall of the imperial state or something like that. But I think it's part of that process of falling, I suppose I would say. So because I think it's woven through, that in some ways made it easier to grapple with the Soviet chapters or the Soviet chapter, which was, to me, the most intimidating chapter to approach, again, because I had really never written about the Soviet Union before. And because there are these very disparate visions of Soviet food, because there is, of course, hunger as a major part of that, whether that is the collectivization famines, which is, of course, the Holodomor and also the Kazakh famine, which, of course, Sarah Cameron has just written this great book about. You know, so there's a lot of, you know, this is a really visible thing. There is the starvation during the siege of Leningrad. There's other problems with food supply during the war. There's the famine that's right after the Second World War, as well as the famine in the 1920s. So it's like, so it is this sort of very present thing, and not talking about that would make no sense. But then there are also these sort of amazing, really, like, and it seems strange to talk about the 1930s as a time where there are fun stories, but there are fun stories about food in the 1930s. you know, because mm-hmm. of Mikoyan and his sort of vision of Soviet abundance, and, you know, and some of the bits and pieces that, you know, sort of came out there are just sort of amazing. And that is part of the story, even if it's not necessarily reflective of the experience of an awful lot of the people living in the Soviet Union. So trying to balance those visions of, you know, like the feasts that are portrayed in the book of Tasty and Healthy Food versus the reality of a lot of people having significantly more restricted sort of opportunities for eating, even if it's not full-fledged famine, still having less access to goods, was something that I tried to really figure out how to handle. And so I think I ended up trying to focus on the story of hunger in the Soviet Union, the vision of plenty in the Soviet Union, and then sort of everyday realities that were somewhere in between the somewhere in between the two, as my way of mm-hmm. kind of grappling with the Soviet story.
Mm-hmm. I also get the impression, Allison, and thanks for that, that in many ways you're returning to your former self in the end of the book, and mm-hmm. because, you know, you first came to the Russian Federation, and it's a first person narrative in 1992 on a language program, and so you begin picking up what you had written as an observer. Mm-hmm. Then you're actually, you know, talking about your staple meals and Fanta and McDonald's. I love that story about McDonald's. I wonder if you might share that, you know, sort of, again, an archaeological digging up your self from the 1990s.
Yeah, that was, so the epilogue, it's not quite long enough to call it a chapter, so I called it an epilogue, which is the sort of post-Soviet experience. And of course, that's the part of Russian history that, you know, my first trip it was actually 1991, so I'm almost up to the 30-year anniversary of my first trip to Russia. And going in the fall of 1991 was quite an interesting time, I guess I will put it that way, to have as your first trip to this brand new state, which is the Russian Federation. And so, you know, I found that a really enjoyable and really enlightening thing to write, because I tried to interweave my own experiences of eating in Russia. And apologies, there's a dog barking outside, so I hope it's not too audible right now. But tried to my own memories of food. And like, I'm not quite sure I would say that I'm a foodie, but I do, you know, like I like food. I pay attention to food. Yeah. So it is a part of my memory. Even, you know, I had this journal that I kept on my first trip. So I used that for some specific things, but a lot of it is just coming from memory. But then mm-hmm. this gave me the chance to kind of pull back from my own personal history and personal memories and try to figure out what was going on behind the scenes, even if I didn't understand it at the time. So to understand what things like
the ruble crisis,
the multiple ruble crises, what was going on in terms of the privatization of collective farms and what that meant for food supply, you know, just sort of really look into a lot of the things that were going on that were why on that first trip, the stores had nothing, but a few markets did, and why kiosks popped up all over the place in the middle of the 90s or early in the 90s, and sort of kiosk land became my way of getting most things. And then why kiosks, you know, were like in Moscow, at least, were just completely taken out a few years back in this sort of city beautifying process. You know, just all of these mm-hmm. different visions of trying to understand a little bit more what was going on that level of, you know, my experiences in Russia. Because, of course, we pay attention to kind of larger political things, but what sort of lies under, like, literally the everyday process of going to, whether it's a McDonald's on, I think I admit to the fact that I cried when I first saw McDonald's in Moscow in 1991. I was on a language program living in Krasnodar in southern Russia for most of the fall. And we went up for this trip to Moscow and St. Petersburg after having been there for a couple of months. And I will admit, I got teary when I saw the McDonald's. It just seemed like this thing that reminded me of home. And like, and not that I actually went to McDonald's that often, but mm-hmm. still it was there. It was this part of this thing.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But I love that. I mean, in many ways, also because you're revisiting the cost of food. I mean, you're actually trying to see this in, I think, in ways that expats often forget, from the standpoint of your host and from the families where, you know, you're living and you're staying, or maybe renting a room for a short amount of time, and you know, then you come back to your sort of like rich Western academic life. But I mean, you actually pay very close attention to the cost of bread and the cost of meats, and what, you know, what happens, I would say, even through the 90s to the 2000s in terms of scale and agriculture.
Yeah.
And I guess that's, you know, that's something that there's certainly a whole lot more to be done about, you know, garden plots and sushi restaurants and the explosions of Georgian restaurants and in places that are in many ways far away from Moscow and St. Petersburg and from, you know, the libraries and archives where we become comfortable. And I guess that's a bigger question for you now, since we're beginning to run out of time. I wondered if you might suggest some books, either books about food. You already mentioned, you know, Trish Starks. I think there's Dara Goldstein as well, and other people. I mean, maybe you have some books in mind for us here at New Books Network to suggest.
Sure. A couple of them are, I think, people that you've already interviewed in some ways. And some of it's also not just on food. But of course, Steve Bittner has his new book on wine in the history of wine in Russia, which is, I think, a really fun, fun's maybe not quite the right word. I hope you're okay with that, Steve, if you're listening to this. But it's, I think, a good exploration of something that people don't really think about when they think about Russia, and yet does have this very distinct history that sort of hits on some of these same beats, those sort of questions of production and questions of consumption and its role on the table and in different kinds of discourse. And then there's an edited volume that came out, I think, in 2019 called Seasoned Socialism, which it's an edited volume by Anastasia Lakhtikova, Angela Brentlinger, and Irina Glushenko. And it's got some really lovely articles in it. It's mostly about late Soviet Russia. So I would say the majority of it is sort of the Brezhnev era, but it's a bit more sort of, some of it reaches back to the larger post-war era in general. And I think we have a lot, even if we didn't necessarily experience some of these things, certainly, you know, there were visions of what food was like in, say, the 1980s. I mean, you had all those visions of people waiting in line. And this gives us really, a few of the chapters give really interesting visions of what that experience was like. It's funny, I read it to review it last year at the beginning of lockdown, and when there were so many shortages in all sorts of places. And it was a really interesting experience reading these descriptions of how people kind of coped with different kinds of shortages in this very brief moment in the end, in which there were shortages all around. So I found it a very intriguing thing to read at that particular time. And just sort of thinking back, you know, there's a lot of discussion of the ways that food, despite or maybe because of some of its challenges in access, really continued to play an important role of something that people wanted to put time into preparing to feed people well, to sort of really do this. And it is an interesting idea of the ways that sort of living in sort of a stressful time can not push people away from that, but actually maybe even build it up a little bit more. And I felt that that was something that really resonated in the sort of, you know, the everybody start a sourdough or make focaccia or whatever it is that people were doing last year, you know.
Right. And share, and, you know, and sharing recipes in the internet. I mean, this is such a burgeoning, it's just message boards. I guess, you know, well beyond the, as you say, well beyond the utilitarian element.
Oh, totally.
Let's talk about your, and finally, you know, let's talk about your current research. So I understand that you're working on your cheese master again and Gatchina. So tell us about your current book projects.
This is a challenging question at the moment. So a few years back, actually it's more than a few at this point, I think it's getting on towards 7 years ago, I started looking into records about the palace and town of Gatchina, which turned out also to involve a bunch of the villages in the area, because there was at one point a royal estate of Gatchina that encompassed the palace and then a series of villages and their inhabitants. One of the villages was called Gatchina, and it was made into a town by Emperor Paul very shortly after he came to the throne, because this was one of his residences. And it turns out that the archival records for Gatchina are truly amazing. And that has to do with some peculiarities of its administration and governance. But there's just so much fascinating material that digs into, or not digs into, but just sort of lays out all sorts of just kind of everyday stories of people living in these villages, in the town, and even to an extent the Romanovs, who occasionally lived in the palace. It wasn't a major palace. It's not the Winter Palace. It's not Peterhof. But Emperor Paul and then later Alexander III spent large chunks of time at the palace, and others sort of spent time in between. So the project kind of has evolved. I came to it after having gone there and being sort of intrigued by it and thinking, I wonder if there's something to do about that. And then it turned out that the archives are pretty amazing. So there's so much in the archives that I've sort of been struggling a bit with how to pull it all together. So there are some things like I randomly ordered an archival file that was literally the case of the dead cheese master, or Diella. I'm translating Diella as case, but I think that's legitimate. And which turned out to be the story of a Swiss cheesemaker who made cheese at Gatchina in the 1790s and who died under actually not that mysterious circumstances. And just sort of looking into the file and thinking what you could tell from this one archival file. So in the end, I'm sort of simultaneously working on two different book projects, one of which kind of tries to really celebrate the detail in some of the specific archival files by having a chapter that just lets me dive deeply into the story of one of the files. So the case of the cheese master would be one. There's some others. There's a wonderful case of a noble woman who is incensed that a policeman called her T instead of V, called her with the informal U as opposed to the formal U. And there's a few other sort of really interesting things that I think will be part of that. And that one I've been sort of piecing together bit by bit. And then the other will be, I think, a bit more of a standard academic monograph. And the thing that's ended up really pulling me is thinking about sort of what it means or what it meant, like practically on an everyday basis, that Russia was an autocracy. Like what did how did individual like residents of the town of Gatchina or of the villages around there interact with autocratic structures of authority? Of course, it's a little bit weird to look at that at a place where the Tsar actually literally sometimes showed up, but right. I think that's actually part of the thing that makes it a really interesting, because you see lot of the structures kind of in miniature there. Policing
everyday life, diet, nutrition. Yeah. I mean, even where they're going, right? I mean, if they leave the residence, I think that would be fascinating. I mean, I'm so interested in many of the social history elements that you weave into the story of food. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, you know, let's talk about cheese when you're finished with the book. I love that internet poll that 64% of Russians would choose cheese over Crimea. That's a fascinating story, as you know, with all the counter sanctions, they're trying to develop their own sort of Russian version, Ruski Bri and Russian Parmesan and so forth. So, I hope we can do this again when the dead cheese master is dead.
That'd be good. Yeah, I actually have an article that I need to revise this summer about cheese, that just focuses on cheese, because it turns out there's a whole cheese story, which is unexpected, but that's pretty fun. But yeah, I will, you know, it's funny, being department chair has slowed my writing process down a bit. But honestly, and this is only half a joke, it has also helped me kind of grapple with this question of like, what is an autocracy and what does it mean? And it's sort of thinking about, you know, obviously being a department chair is not actually being an autocrat, but there are certain ways, or at least it shouldn't be being an autocrat, but there are interesting ways in which sort of the hierarchical structures of a university tell you interesting things about some of the hierarchical structures of hierarchical institutions like an autocratic state. So it's been surprisingly generative, yeah, I would say, in my approach to the subject. Even though, well, if any colleagues happen to listen to this, I hope you recognize that I am actually trying with all my heart not to be an autocrat.
Well, fantastic. In the name of Soslovia and democracy and cheese, I congratulate you, Allison Smith, on your book. I am Steven Siegel, and we've been talking here on the New Books Network podcast, New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies and New Books Food, with Allison Smith. Her new book is Cabbage and Caviar, A History of Food in Russia, just out with the University of Chicago Press and Reaction Books in 2021. Thanks so much again, Allison, for joining me.
Thanks again for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
And to all our listeners, until next time.